Good morning, all. This is 9 a.m. on February 15th, 2022, and time to convene the regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. And first, I want to check in with everybody. Hope you all have recovered from Sunday's Super and Puppy Bowl, which were nail biters, and yesterday's Valentine's sugar overload. So time to get back to work. Sorry, you know, I just got to go there. I'm Toni Olson, president of the commission, and in accordance with the governor's proclamation 2028-15, we are holding meetings remotely. Online, we have Commissioner Rebecca Wolf, our vice president, Commissioner Sid Logan, secretary, John Harlow, our CEO, general manager, Ann Spangler, general counsel, Melissa Collins, commission and executive services director, and Jenny Rich, deputy clerk of the board. The written record will indicate others who are present. And please remember to mute your devices when not speaking. Now, this part of our agenda this morning is a session for John Harlow to discuss issues on certain topics among ourselves and with PUD staff. If there is public request for comment and time remains, 15 minutes will be allowed at the end of the briefing session. I will now turn it over to John.
Thanks, Commissioner Olson. Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
Happy Tuesday. So to your questions, Commissioner Olson, I
you know, I gotta go there, John.
Oh, it's great. Yesterday, not only Valentine's Day, but my 41st wedding anniversary, and I did a lot of chocolate. So,
well, congratulations. That's great.
I buy my wife chocolate knowing that she doesn't like it. So somebody has to eat it.
I love it.
Congratulations on 41 years.
Yeah.
Oh, that is impressive.
Yesterday was my bride's birthday as well.
Oh.
Excellent. So first up is our community engagement and Aaron Swaney to give us an overview of our new power talks. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, commissioners.
Morning.
Hopefully everybody can hear me okay. Aaron Swaney, media and public relations. Yeah, I'm here this morning to talk a little bit about power talks. We're really excited about this new communications channel and opportunity to engage with our customers. So we recently launched these in January, and we feel like they're a great way to interact with our customers. The concept is simple. So we invite the customers to kind of a lunchtime chat on a subject. So in January, we did outages. In February, we did rates. And then we have a PUD expert on the topic give a high-level presentation. And then we allow for Q&A at the end. And we do all this on Microsoft Teams, so it's virtual. So pretty much anybody can take part. Like I said, we've done two so far. We've done one on outages, how to respond to them, or how the PUD responds to them, and then also how customers can be prepared for them. So Paul Kiss helped us out by talking about how the PUD line crews and service crews respond to outages, how we prepare for them as we go into fall and winter. And then Kelly Stickney in our group presented on how customers can be prepared. So how they can build an emergency kit and all the kind of stuff that goes with that. In February, we had a Power Talks on rates with Brian Booth. This was well attended. So we had about 40 customers and we had about 60 employees. We actually had more people register and we actually record these so that anybody who registers for them can get the recording and see that later. And we've been getting a lot of emails for customers who say they can't come to the initial presentation, but they're really looking forward to seeing the presentation later. So we're excited about that as well. And Brian did a great job. We got good questions from customers, kind of really about the rate restructuring and how that was going to affect their business or their bill. We got a nice comment from a customer just saying how much they appreciated that we were public power and looking out for their interests. So far, all thumbs up. So like I said, we've had good participation. We're going to continue going forward with some of the topics like smart planting we're doing in March. So we're going to have Rich Lloyd from our vegetation management group, who's going to come in and talk about, you know, where to plant your trees and bushes to keep them away from power lines and transformers. And then in April for Earth Month, Earth Day, around that, we're going to do one on conservation and kind of do almost like a virtual tour through your house and talk about where people can, you know, either do weatherization or where they can make improvements in their house to help with conservation. The reason behind that we wanted to launch these is because we know that our customers are interested in what the PUD is doing. We also know that communication channels are changing. You know, we can't just send out a bill stuffer and expect customers to get the information. They want to interact with us in different ways, especially with the virtual world changing and people doing more of the Microsoft Teams and right now, like we're doing Zoom. So people are getting more accustomed to these channels and we want to meet them where they're at. So doing something like this where they can interact with us and ask us questions and get the information straight from our experts, we thought was a great idea. Going forward in 2022, we just hope to continue to grow our audience as they become more accustomed to finding us here and coming to Microsoft Teams and watching these presentations. We have a long list of topics, as you can imagine, with a diverse company or organization like ours. So we're talking about ConnectUp, obviously, would be a great one. Microgrid and battery storage, solar. You know, how do you put a solar array in your house? How do you do those kind of things? We can have our experts talk about. So we're really excited about these, and I'd encourage you commissioners to come to our March 2nd presentation on smart planting.
Thank you.
You bet.
Well, that is exciting. Getting 40 people to come from the public. That's really wonderful. Thank you. I've been seeing all the marketing, so I'm glad.
Yeah, glad we're doing that. That is a very creative way of reaching customers with the backstory. Because a concern I've had over the many years is that, you know, customers don't see what's behind restoring power. They don't see what's behind the importance of being prepared for a power outage. So this is a great opportunity, and I wish we could get a lot more customers to participate.
We're trying, definitely.
Well, now, is this in the during the day or in the evening?
Yeah, it's at lunch. So we do them from noon to one, just hoping that customers can come during that time. But as this goes forward, we're not, you know, we could do some in the evening. It just depends on where we see how people want to interact with us.
And how do people get the recordings?
So the recordings are usually put up on the website. If you register for the event, we send out an email afterwards with all the recordings, links to kind of relevant information. If anybody who registers gets the recording right away.
Great, that's wonderful. And Teams is available to anybody you have to get the app, right?
Yeah, you'd have to download the app. I think you can get it through like a web page, something like that. Okay. But yeah, you just have to download the app.
Thank you.
And you can get it on your phone or iPad or whatever.
Yeah, right, sure.
Very, very creative. Thumbs up.
Thank you, everybody.
Yep. Excellent job, Aaron. Thank you. So next up is the legislative update that was provided in your packet, and we have our outstanding GR team here to answer any questions.
I have a question. It's not really about the report. It's really about something that's in the report, and that is I'm wondering where we are in interacting with PPC or Bonneville around starting up this smelter up in Ferndale and the power it's going to use.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. I think you're referring to one of the articles that was posted in the GR activities report. I don't have an answer to that. I don't know, but it's something I can definitely look into. I don't know if Kim or anyone else has an answer for that.
Not off the top of my head, but we can poke around for an answer for you.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Olson here, and now I can't find the bill. The bill regarding converting from electric to natural gas, or is it the other way around? Is it the other way around?
Other way around.
If you're referring... I can't find the bill. So I saw early on in your report that the cutoff date for bills to move was the 3rd.
So there's...
Then they need to move out of the policy committee.
Yeah, there's been a couple more cutoffs. So we actually, today is the House of Origin cutoff as well. So yeah, if for instance, referencing 1767 House Bill, 1767 being a House bill, at the end of today would need to be out of the House to continue moving through the process.
Oh, okay.
Again, that applies to bills that are not considered necessary to implement the budget.
Yeah.
As we've talked before, that what falls under that category is a little bit open to interpretation.
Oh, for this bill?
I'd say in general. So, you know, there could be an argument that this bill is necessary to implement the budget, or maybe there's not. But if it's not considered necessary to implement the budget, it would need to be out by the end of today.
Okay, thank you. Let's see, John, are we going to move on to the next budget item? Our next,
yep.
Talking about budgets, the next agenda item.
Yeah, budget on the brain. Yes, if there's no more questions on our legislative topics, we will move on to our safety update from Rob Beidler. Good morning, Rob.
Morning, John. Morning, Commission.
Good morning.
Budget, safety, we'll roll safety. I have a little presentation for you here. Talk about 2021 and what that brought and what 2022 will bring in part. This next slide here just gives you the things I'm going to talk about in 2021. Is this for me to move? Slides?
Click on it and then you can control it.
Got it. I don't need to talk about each one of those because I got a slide for each one of these, but that's just so that you have a brief to take a look at when it comes to 2021. It was a great year. The first, we start really big picture. This was our recordable injury rate for 2021. And as you see in red there, it was a 4.24. And that is the lowest recordable injury rate that we have had in some 40 years here in the district. Now, what is a recordable injury? There's just a lot of criteria that they put out that whether it's a hospitalization or the severity of the injury and so on, it meets these certain criteria to be considered a recordable injury. So as you can see, 2021 was absolutely a banner year when it came to that. Now, it's not...
Excuse me, this is Commissioner Olson.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about this. Is there any comparable in terms of national averages so we can compare ourselves?
Yes. Now, OSHA industry-wide, like all of the ones out there that OSHA measures, was about a 4.5, over a 4.5. And that was what we can measure ourselves. Now, I actually, for you, and I apologize that I wasn't able to do it, I attempted to get an average recordable injury rate for public utilities. And I haven't been able to do that so mm-hmm. far. So that would be a really great number to have moving forward into the future to be able to see our peers and how we stack up.
Yeah. Thank you.
Now, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just chime in a little bit. My experience and have been involved in the history, not just with public utilities, but all utilities, investor-owned and publics, and benchmarking safety. It is pretty close. The 4.24 is pretty close to what would be considered the industry 50th percentile or kind of mid-range from a OSHA recordable perspective. So, you know, for us, I look at this more about where we, less about where we are related to other utilities or the overall industry, and more about our trends. And that's the positive that I pull out of this.
Absolutely.
We've got a lot of good things going on. Rob's doing a great job of leading the efforts to just continue to trend this number down. And if we keep doing the right things and move the culture in the direction it needs to move, the numbers will take care of themselves. And I'll also add, an OSHA recordable injury is really anything over first aid. So if you get a prescription for pain medication, that's an OSHA recordable. So the threshold is really pretty low for what can be, what goes into the record, so to speak, for an OSHA recordable. So it's pretty low threshold as far as what gets recorded as an injury. So again, less about the numbers, more about how we just continue to change the culture and focus on risk and mitigating risk. Sorry, Rob.
I just want to say congratulations on so much progress. It's really impressive.
It is impressive. I was just going to say, when you look at that previous slide and you can see that it's been running double to triple.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Where we are. I mean, that is really impressive.
Mm-hmm. And that's through Commissioner Olson, that's through multiple different programs throughout those years. And one of them, which is in the early 2000s, where you see the most, that's where we hired a consultant to come in and set up a new program, and it got worse. So kudos, you're doing something right. That's great.
I'll tell you the biggest impact, at least from my perspective, is employee ownership. If you look at the quality of our safety meetings, mm-hmm. and leadership commitment, those are the two, I think, things that move the needle the most. When you have the folks that are closest to the action who are really the ones that are you know, kind of in harm's way, engaged in the capacity that we do, figuring out how to be, you know, how to identify those hazards, those risks, and putting plans in place and holding each other accountable, I think that's really the root of what's behind the improvement in performance.
Yeah, and also just encouraging the openness and, as you say, helping each other to be more aware. But then when they are aware of something, or if they feel that maybe they've made a mistake, there's no harm or no shame in bringing that out.
Oh, yeah, that's
and that's part of that continuous improvement program that is overall throughout the whole district, the whole PUD.
Yeah, well said, Commissioner Wolf.
Yeah, everybody that just spoke in so many words talked about culture. And that is our drive and our mission. That's how you really move the needle, is culture. That we want to send everybody home the same way they came to us in the morning when they came to work. This slide, now recordable injuries is one thing, but I absolutely love this number. I mean, when you look at the number of days lost, either restricted days or days lost because of recordable injuries, those numbers are staggering. And we've made so much progress. Every one of those days that you see that it's gone down is, again, somebody getting home the same way they came to us. You know, it's not all about, hey, we want you to be able to work and, you know, and back the on and on. It is just about the health and well-being of them. And that's a lot of healthy days there.
Could you explain to me what are restricted days? Lost days, that means that they just can't come to work because of the injury?
Yeah, I'll give you.
Mm-hmm. I'm just not familiar with the term restricted days.
Yeah, I'll give you a common example. Let's just say, somebody in the field, use any job, we could say lineman, maybe has a significant sprained knee, you know, maybe some torn cartilage or whatever. They can still move, they can still get around, but they just can't do their primary function. So we'll, excuse me, we'll have them come work in the tool room. And there's a ton of, you know, there's a ton of work that can be done in there. So we could call that restricted because they're not doing their primary function, but we are still be able to do a light duty capacity.
Thank you. That makes, and then lost is they just can't work on that day. Mm-hmm. So if they miss 2 days a week, those are two lost days, right? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Rob, this is Commissioner Olson again. Maybe it's on another slide, and this is only one data point, but there are large dollars associated with this as well, correct? Savings.
Yes. For example, let's just use the example I just talked about. Maybe the tool room is short-staffed and they can really use the help. I have actually had people on light duty or restricted here in safety helping us get caught up. And that is overtime that's not being spent, you know, at times. So yeah, there can be a shocking amount of safety and, or excuse me, money savings in all of these numbers that you're seeing.
Yeah. Thank you.
And I would just even pile on to that, even if you just look at it, which I typically don't because I don't like pulling money into the conversation around safety.
Yeah, I know.
But for this particular data point, and many companies do measure this, if you look at work comp claims and the amount of dollars
on
work comp claims, this trend is significant from a dollar savings perspective.
Thank you.
Another great trend I wanted to show you briefly, vehicle incidents. So the green line that you see are preventable accidents. The lower line is just simply straight up backing collisions where we backed into something. Now, driving is one of the most dangerous things that we do. It can cause some of the most significant injuries, not just for us, but for the general public. So again, great trends. The reason when you see the miles driven, I put that in there because some people might say, okay, well, great. 2021 was a really low year because of COVID and we weren't driving as much or we weren't as at work as much. Well, that's not actually true. We drove as much in 2021 as we had in the past 5 years. And that's why I gave you that trend. So we're driving the same number of miles and we have a lot less collisions. And again, a lot less injuries, a lot less lost time. Those are all related. Now I'm going to get into so there's some data for you. Now, like here's some changes and some things that we did that we're proud of in safety in 2021. We have a lot of contractors out there and I don't need to read the slide to you, but I will only say that a lot of contractor incidents, whether it was encroachments or dig-ins, can cause significant safety concerns for the general public, for those contractors, and for our personnel. So we've instituted a lot. We respond to every one of them. We talk to every contractor. We interview them. We have L&I looped in. We have a great working relationship with them that we continue to foster. We also now have a database for every time that there's been an incident or a violation or there's, so now we can kind of track who the frequent flyers are, you know, those that are continuously violating the same rules. Oh, and there are some out there.
Rob, what is an APP review? APP.
That is a safety review. And I'm sorry, I was told to keep the acronyms down. We go to every site and review the accident form or the accident, the report that is done. And it's also, we review site plans and project plans and so on. So it's a long-winded way or short-winded way of saying that we respond to everything and do our own safety inspection with the contractor and with the planning that was done ahead of time.
So APP is... is it regional, national, or just for us?
I don't remember the acronym. I'd be honest with you. I don't remember that what APP is. I just know that Kevin Davis, who's my expert in the field in safety, put it in there and I didn't change it.
Okay. Thank you.
I hate giving the answer. I don't know, but.
Rob, what I'm hearing is much closer oversight of the work that's being done by contractors. Do the public works contracts still have a requirement that the contractor submits safety plans?
I don't know if Public Works has that requirement.
Okay.
I believe APP stands for Accident Prevention Plan, and it's really the kind of like the tail board or pre-job briefing, only it's just a more formalized process.
Okay.
Yeah, that's correct, John. And district contractors that are working on site are required to provide a safety plan, before they start their work. So that's part of that review.
Thank you.
Okay, storm response. We know the costs and the dangers associated with storms, and we know the impact to our customers, obviously. So I'm the senior manager in charge of safety, security, and emergency management. And so we have embedded ourselves in our storm response. We are in the storm center 24/7. As long as there is an active storm, we have safety personnel in the field. As long as there's an active storm, we have emergency management in dispatch and ECC. And so that bullet point that says on the job crew checks and support, we know how hazardous they are. And so when I say we have safety personnel in the field, they are going to those jobs and they are talking to our people in the field and they're working with foremen and others and find out how they can support them, how they can help them, making sure that they not only have the tools that they need, but that they're staying fed and hydrated. And of course, you know, that all important coffee at times, whatever it takes. So from the time the storm center opens, safety and security and emergency management are there now.
This is Jason. I just wanted to give Rob and the safety team a shout out on this one. They have done a phenomenal job in this area, and I receive positive feedback from the crews and the line department on a regular basis. Really what they've done is they've built a relationship there where our crews know when safety shows up, they're there to support them, to help them out in any way they can, and to, you know, just help build a safer work environment. So I think this is just a huge plus and really appreciate the work that Rob and his team have done in this area.
Thanks, Jason. I appreciate that.
I was going to say, I can imagine how storm response could be particularly dangerous because the situation is so out of control as compared to replacing something or installing something. Mm-hmm. You probably don't know what you are going to see when you roll up on some of these areas of damage.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
It really goes to the point Rob made earlier that this is a great way for us to demonstrate to our crews that their health and safety is what matters the most. We know they're going to get the job, you know, the outage restored or the work done. But going out and to Jason's point, Rob and his team have just done an amazing job, and it sends a signal to our folks that their health and safety is what matters the most. And that's really, I think, again, back to at the core of the culture that we're trying to create, where it's about looking out for each other and taking care of each other.
My safety team, my safety specialist, they kind of coined this phrase that they started to use this year, which is they say, I got you. And they don't mean it as I got you, like, aha. I mean, like, I got you. I got your back. We're here for you. Another change.
And Rob, you, this Commissioner Olson, I had on the tip of my tongue that very thing, where they're in support of, they, rather than going out and looking for problems and blaming somebody. And that existed at one point. So thumbs up on this one.
Mm-hmm. I was just curious, do the safety crew members, do they wear like something that distinguishes them from other, do they like have a safety jacket or assist safety crew?
No, we do wear proper PPE. We do wear, you know, of course, reflective vests, and when applicable, you know, fire resistant and so on. But we don't have anything that recognizes us as safety. But we worked so hard this year at getting to know everybody and being there for them. Sure. I would venture to guess that 9 out of 10 times when we walk up, they call us by our first name. You know, they're getting to know us. They know that we're there to support them. So hopefully we don't need it very long.
Okay, good.
Now, this may seem a little bit insignificant to some, but we made a huge change in what we do with what you could call biohazard, you know, syringes and sharps. We come across them all over the district, you know, over 100 different work locations, if you incorporate substations and other things into that. And we come across a lot of bad stuff. So we don't want our people handling it. Secondary exposures, you know, there's so many things that can go wrong. So we have changed how we work as a district. Now we have security. We want security called anytime anybody comes across any of those hazards. Then we respond, and our security personnel are trained. They have the proper PPE and they have the proper disposal for those sharps. And we have contracted with BioClean. That's why that's up there, that we now have one single location where we can dispose of all of those things safely, not only environmentally safe, but for our personnel. When I came into safety, not a really super long time ago, I noticed that there were large boxes in different locations around the district of hazardous, what you could call waste. And so that's something we cleaned up.
Great. That's great.
And again, this is unfortunate sign of the times. As we talk about syringes and waste, we also know that we have had personnel in the field come across what they believed were controlled substances. And I would get a phone call that says, hey, this is what I found. What should I do with it? And I'm like, please don't touch it. And fentanyl exposure, you know, is unbelievably hazardous and could be fatal if inhaled or just touched. And we had no program. And as it's becoming more and more common, we decided we really, really needed one. So we started fentanyl awareness training. And then an antidote for fentanyl, if somebody's exposed and is overdosed, is naloxone. And so we're going through naloxone training district-wide. And this is a slide just to give you a tidbit of what we're training. And naloxone will be at every location in the district that there's an AED. So it's in all of our first aid stations and all of our vehicles that have AEDs and so on. So what you see on the left, signs of an opioid overdose, we are training to that. It's more than just this slide, but that's a glimpse of the training. How to administer naloxone. There's another piece of that training that's going around district-wide.
So I'm really ignorant about fentanyl, but is that an example of an opioid?
Yes, it's a synthetic opioid that is hundreds of times more powerful than the opioids that you would actually come across in a natural form.
Right.
Ms. Tony, I'm not quite, is this in terms of administering district folks, or are these customers?
Anybody.
Okay.
Yep. Hmm. Yep. Anybody. It's a, you know, for lack of a better term, it's a nasal spray. We don't have to teach people how to do injections and stick them with needles, nothing like that. It's a nasal spray.
Hmm. Do we have any liability for that?
No.
Okay.
Well, okay. No is too strong of a word. That I always give such short answers, and sometimes it comes back that it wasn't the best idea. Case after case after case has been litigated that shows that we should have no liability. It doesn't mean that somebody won't sue us, but generally there's a lot of case law out there that says we're good. If you were to give naloxone to somebody who has not overdosed, and maybe they just had a heart attack or some other medical emergency, it is not harmful.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think there's been some state laws around this too, so to make the delivery of naloxone.
I think it's Good Samaritan laws.
Good Samaritan laws.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
You know, I think fire departments, police officers, mm-hmm. others are carrying naloxone in vehicles. I think it's just become a widespread way to deal with the epidemic.
Hmm. Yeah, the vast majority of emergency responders have had the same training and carry the same thing in their vehicles. Hmm. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that we had a great partnership with Stille to help us get the naloxone. Dr. Jill, in 2022, I have a slide down here a little bit that will talk about that. But I wanted to give you a brief at some of our Dr. Jill numbers and successes. She was here in the building today visiting crews, and she's a great resource for people that I believe that we're on a path to using more and more and more with people with awareness and being able to do it remotely and in person. All of those things are really, really helping. Mm-hmm. One thing that, and I know that that a lot of people that are on this actually went to this training. Prior to 2021, we didn't have necessarily a comprehensive active threat response training. Some people call it active shooter, but it's not always a shooter. So we call it active threat. A nationally recognized program that came into the district, and we taught a ton of classes, put several hundred of our employees through. Some people before COVID really put a crimp on things. We had a lot of outside participation with the city of Everett and others. This is, again, one of those things that we know that the worst of the worst is possible, and we want our people prepared. There had been some similar training in pieces around the district, but we wanted everybody to have the same comprehensive training, so everybody knew what everybody else was trained to do in case of one of these situations.
Rob, Commissioner Wolf here. If we go back to in-person meetings, would you provide that for the commissioners?
I would be honored. Yes, I would love for you guys to come to our fentanyl training, our naloxone training, our active threat response, and this one you guys will love, de-escalation training, which was new in 2021. Mm-hmm. De-escalation training is basically dealing with people in crisis. That could be somebody who is just angry. That could be somebody who maybe is under the influence of opioids or anything else, or suffering from some kind of mental illness. It's a 1-hour de-escalation class that we offer to everybody in the district. It's really relevant and very useful for anybody that can get to it.
Rob, this is Commissioner Olson. We need to make sure that Commissioner Logan and myself have interest in this before we would have commissioners attend these things.
Oh, you bet.
Commissioner Logan?
I don't know that I need the training, but, personally.
All right, but you're open to...
I'm open to it. I'm open to everything almost.
In these specific areas.
Yeah.
Commissioner Olson, this is Melissa. I just want to add, I've also talked to Rob about doing commission meeting safety training. Since I've been at the district, it's something that we haven't done. So I've talked to him about coming in and doing a training with the commissioners if there's a threat in the actual commission.
Outstanding.
Kind of what our steps are. So we will work on that as well.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, outstanding.
Well, I would be interested in attending some of these. And so I hope that my fellow commissioners would agree that it's a good idea. I mean, the more you know, the more helpful you can be. My partner helped save a life because he remembered his CPR on the tennis court a couple of years ago. And just having the knowledge can help save lives. And so you never know when you might be in a situation, you know, where you would benefit from having this knowledge and this training. So
these really are excellent trainings. And kind of the cool thing is they're not videos or anything like that, but it's our own in-house trainer in the safety department who puts these on. It's very engaging. He's just an excellent trainer.
Need to think about this. I certainly think there's some of these that would be valuable for commissioners to have more information on or participate. There are some that are clearly more operational. So, or I was thinking perhaps the commissioners could have a briefing where you kind of bring them all together. We are remote, so I don't know how that factors into it. But some of these things have piqued my interest, but I'm not sure that the commissioners would need to get into backing up and those kinds of that kind of training, because that is strictly operational.
Well, you're right, I'm sure, but I think we have the ability to discern what would be appropriate for us. I would not, I mean, maybe I need the backup training, but I wouldn't put that one. And how to prevent falls, I might need that one. You know.
Well, as board president, commissioners, I will pursue this and see what we can come up with. Thank you, let's move on.
You bet. Now we're gonna get a glimpse of 22. What's coming. Dr. Jill, so we took a very, very broad poll about what people saw that they really liked, what they would like to see in the future. And we think we've come up with a great plan for 2022. As one thing I would say that I didn't incorporate the numbers in here, but we did in our very first with some of the new programming. Earlier this month, we had more people attend on a particular day than we had on any particular day all of last year. And it's because of one, obviously, nutrition, shoulders, backs, all of those things. And so we think we have a great snapshot of what our people want to see. So more stuff to follow for 22. We have had pieces of driving training, and it is a requirement. We do have to have driver training here at the district for some personnel. But it was kind of a one size fits all. So we've developed a comprehensive driving program that it touches on some of these things that we actually reviewed this morning, and we think that we're ready to launch sometime soon. We're going to start with fleet. It is classroom, it is practical skills, and there's different aspects of the training depending on what job you have here at the district. So we may not have necessarily the same defensive driving class that we would have in meter reading that we would have for a CDL holder who's driving a Vactor truck, you know. So we're really excited about that. Also, we have dramatically expanded our basic first aid. We have put together a first aid committee that will have multiple instructors on some of the things that you just saw, maybe whether it's fentanyl training, Narcan application. We've upgraded all of our first aid kits at locations, and those will start to rotate out and sought other members of the district, whether it's facilities or custodial that can help us make sure that those are taken care of every day and that we're not missing anything. We've also added tourniquets and the training on how to apply them. Not to get too deep into the weeds, but I think that some people don't realize that a lot of times in major incidents and catastrophes that, you know, people die from shock and bleeding to death more than just about anything else. And so we want to make sure that all of our personnel are ready for that. CDL program. commercial driver's license program. So and again, this is, I'll be very brief. We have people that have to have them, hundreds of people. They have to have them to do their job here. And I would say that the program has been split up in a lot of different areas, a lot of kind of different keepers of different parts of it. I think we can deliver a great service to our own people, make the process a lot more streamlined. We'll dedicate resources to it. And eventually, because of the sensitive information, because of all the physicals that people have to take and the things that they have to report and doctor's visits, it will eventually be housed in human resources, where that confidential information can be stored securely.
This is Commissioner Olson, CDL. So then from this, they go to get their certification?
So a lot of times people will come here with that certification. Other times they will obtain it while they're here early on in their careers. Okay. So it's kind of both.
Okay, thank you.
And John touched on this earlier. So historically, our safety meetings, they're either monthly or bimonthly. All of the individual groups throughout the district have different areas of expertise and different jobs. And the safety department would do a lot of those for them. That's a lot of meetings. There are over 30 groups out there that have safety meetings, and they also have pre-meetings to get ready for the safety meetings. And so here we are in safety, and we're not experts in all of their fields. We don't know what rising issues are. We don't know what the problem of the day is. We don't always know, you know, technically what they do for a living, yet we're leading them through these safety meetings. And so we started a shift in 2021, and I believe we've completed that shift. Moving forward into 2022. Each one of those departments has a safety chair that's been selected within that group, and they are experts in their field. They know, you know, what equipment issues they're having, what problems in the field, what training they need, and so on. There's that ownership, that engagement. And also, selfishly, not really selfishly, but technically, but both, where the safety department is gaining these unbelievable advocates in safety through these safety chairs, not just for that year, but forever. They're invested, they're part of it. And we keep talking culture, 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 you know, and I think that there's a huge shift in that culture right now. And it's a good one. So I won't go super deep into this. This is something that we will have by the end of this year. A safety walk program for leadership, you know, foremen, managers, senior managers, everybody in their areas. It's one thing to be able to walk around and make sure that people are doing things right. You know, that I got you we're talking about. This isn't about like, hey, I got you doing something wrong. This is about them and being able to track and document that they're supporting their people, but it will be data driven. I can go to a certain group and I can say at the beginning of the year, hey, listen, historically, for the last 5 years, here's where all the problems are in your group. You know, you've had these shoulder injuries, or you've had, you know, these falls or back injuries or collisions or whatever. So we can develop a safety walk program for those leaders that is area specific to where they're working, as opposed to just send a document out to 150 managers and say, hey, do this weekly. It's personalized. Mm-hmm. And they can personalize it too. Leading from the front. I put up there for that up there for a reason. We want our managers to just lead, and they do. They do a great job. So that's all I have for your 21 and 22 brief. Probably took up way more time than I was supposed to, but passionate. Everybody here is passionate about safety.
Well, as Commissioner Olson, Rob, your commissioners were very engaged. So it's not, you didn't make it longer. We did, but it was very, very good information.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Rob, I have one question and sort of a follow-up to that question. So, you know, office workers surprisingly can have a lot of accidents and contribute to, you know, negatively to safety statistics. And I'm wondering, with more people at home, if we've had less of those and if that impacted the numbers. And then on the other side, I have no idea what the Illinois laws are about working from home. And so I'm curious if people hurt themselves at home while working for the PUD, does that count? And are we dealing with claims for injuries at home, from home?
That, yeah, I'll answer as best I can. We have had people while working at home suffer injuries. I'll give you an example of something like carpal tunnel. That is something that, and rightfully so, that they can file a claim for, and it would obviously impact the district because it's a claim. And so, yes, it does happen. The good part of that question, it was all a good question, but the important part is really, did our recordable injury rate go down as far as it did because we don't have as many people in the office? I would answer that by saying we had less people in the office the prior year. So we had more people in the office last year, and the rate still went down. We did have some claims. I cannot give you a comparison, but I'm really interested in that. So I'm going to find one. I'm going to get that data. What's the comparison between the last 3 years for certain work groups that are primarily working from home? I'd like to see that. So I'm sorry that I don't have it.
Thank you.
Now we're extending it even farther, Rob. I apologize. But for in-office folks, it was at one point that one of surprisingly to me, was folks tripping over open file drawers. And since I imagine we don't have too many of those around anymore, that's not an issue. You don't need to respond to it.
I think Dr. Jill helps with all that too, because
people
are more, you know, if they're exercising and they're limber, and there's all mm-hmm. kinds of ways people hurt themselves, but I think good ergonomics. And so,
yeah, that's true.
We're certainly addressing the issue. Yeah.
All right, John, we are now promising to not to continue to pelt Rob with questions.
All good questions and great conversation. Phenomenal job, Rob. And again, really appreciate what you and the team have done to continue to move the culture forward. Great progress.
Thanks, John.
All right, next up is a discussion on our Lower Snake River Dam's engagement principles, and it'll be presented and discussed with Jeff Kellstrom and Garrison Marr. Good morning, Jeff and Garrison.
Good morning.
Excuse me, Garrison. I think, was that Jeff? just want to confirm that this morning's presentation is more to set the schedule for future discussions, not to delve into what the policy statements should be or the board's direction. Because the way I look at it, this is an introduction. We go into a workshop, and that's when our real work begins. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. That's the intention.
Thank you.
All right, so my name is Jeff Kallstrom. I'm the Assistant General Counsel here at the PUD. Garrison Marr will be joining me. He's Senior Manager of Power Supply. As Commissioner Olson said, today's topic does involve the Lower Snake River Dams, but it's at a very high level. See if I have control. There we go. So today we'll be talking about two big topics. First is an informational presentation on the current processes surrounding the Lower Snake River Dams and their future, sort of what those processes are, and get us on the same page as what's going on right now. And then we are going to enter a discussion of some principles for engagement that the district can utilize and district staff can utilize in engaging in those processes. Again, just to reiterate, we as staff are not presenting a proposed position to the board, and we are not asking the commission to take any sort of position on the Lower Snake River Dams in this meeting. That is not what's on the table. Again, we're just talking through some principles that are worthwhile considering as we enter these public venues and have these discussions. And our goal today is to make sure that you, the commission, is comfortable with staff utilizing these principles to guide our engagement. As you mentioned, Commissioner Olson, we are planning future workshops to present the analysis, dive into some of the details, and examine the potential impacts to our customers and how our customers might view these processes and these proposals from the lens of receiving electric power. So that's the intention. So I'll start with some background. We're all aware that there are many regional discussions going on. These are just a couple of the major ones. There is general interest in the lower Snake River dams, or the Snake River in particular, and recovering fish species. In addition, there are some formal processes that have recently concluded or are ongoing. First, the Columbia River Power System Environmental Impact Statement that was issued in 2020. There were some associated biological opinions that were also issued in 2020, and that was covering the operation of the power system on the Columbia and Snake Rivers, a 14 dam system. Those documents were very quickly sued upon, and so there are currently active lawsuits ongoing over the operations of the Columbia River Power System. Those lawsuits are currently stayed as they are, the parties are engaged in settlement discussions to try to come to a conclusion or a settled operational regime. That stay, the litigation is paused until mid-2022, and that's when that could conceivably get going again. In addition, we have a joint federal state process that is sponsored by Senator Murray and Governor Inslee. That kicked off in 2021, and that is also scheduled to conclude in 2022. And then in these discussions that are going on, there are a large variety of factors that are being talked about and being considered. We, the PUD, are a stakeholder because of where our power comes from. We receive at least a portion of our power from the Lower Snake River dams. Therefore, people will want to know, will want to talk to us and see, you know, where we stand, what is important to us, what factors we think about when we think about these dams. And we as staff see this, see those discussion as more than just relaying a position and more than just describing how we're impacted. But it's really engaging in a holistic conversation about where everyone in the room stands and making sure that the people in the room understand where the PUD comes from, what our mission is, and what things are important to us as we consider various options and we consider how we can best serve our customer owners. And so we really just want to make sure that our viewpoint is on the radar of the people who are having these discussions. And so that's where you get into the kind of a general summary of the principles. They're really a collection of things that we want to talk about. It doesn't mean that we have one single solution or any solution at all. It's really just making sure we have a shared understanding of the potential impact of these resources and changes to how these resources are operated. So this is a really quick, high-level informational slide of the Lower Snake River dams. Some of these numbers, especially the combined annual energy production, can vary because, you know, averages can be can utilize different years and also different methodologies. But the main takeaway here is that the four dams have an installed nameplate of a little over 3,000 megawatts. They average a combined production of about 1,000 megawatts, average megawatts. And they do have the ability, in addition to the energy produced, to provide some capacity and to ramp up for, I'd say a medium length of time to assist in certain circumstances. The other piece that's not listed on here, but is important for us to understand, is how these four dams are actually used. They're often talked about four separate facilities. But as far as hydropower generation is concerned, they are four pieces of a 14 dam system that is operated, that is currently operated as a single system. So the Bonneville Power Administration, when they operate these facilities, or at least participate in the marketing of these facilities, they do so as a single unit. And so it's just something to keep in mind as we engage in our discussions moving forward.
That second bullet is quite impressive.
Yes.
So Jeff,
yeah. And
Garrison, if he's on, at what point can we discuss, I mean, I don't want to get into it today, but there's other research which does not agree with the 2,650 for tenant there. And also there have been some studies that show that BPA tends to exaggerate the potential of the four dams. So at what point can we, as knowledgeable commissioners, provide input?
So that's a great question. I think the best opportunity to do that will be the workshop that we're going to look at in second quarter of 22, because in that workshop, we will delve deeper into what these numbers are and the characteristics, as well as circumstances where this comes into play, because it is the case with all hydropower facilities that they produce different amounts during different times of year, depending on certain water conditions and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of factors that go into play, which is Garrison and I spent a lot of time talking about, solid numbers versus, averages and things like that, because there can be fluctuation inherent in any hydropower resource. We see that with the Jackson Project, and we also see that with these facilities as well.
Okay, I'm concerned about the timeline. You said second quarter. That would be what, like April? We'll have a workshop.
I don't believe we've scheduled that yet, John.
Yeah, we have not scheduled it. It would be sometime between April and June.
Okay, so my concern is that the BIOP and the EIS lawsuits and the federal state process with Murray and Inslee, those are both coming due on July 31st. And a lot of the discussion that needs to happen pretty soon, I would think. So I don't want to get left out of this. I don't want to get left behind on it. And I think it's really important that we have our workshop early. And would you prefer that we send in written documents with our concerns and that sort of thing?
I think from my perspective, I don't want to talk too much for Garrison. I think that would be helpful, because it's, again, the sources of data can vary wildly from actual data to forecasting on all sides, and they can generate different numbers. And so it helps us as a staff be as transparent as possible and addressed as directly as possible if we have an understanding of where certain numbers are coming from.
Right. Well, as one of the three policymakers for this PUD, I am very engaged on this, and I don't think it's staff that should be making policy on this. They should be following our guidance, and we follow your guidance on the research that you're doing. So we have to come together on what we're going to discuss and the principles for discussing them.
Yes. And that's one of the reasons we were very conscious of not wanting to dive into a specific position in this meeting, because we have not had that discussion, and we as staff, are not comfortable with that. We've provided you the information, and that we haven't had that discussion yet. And so the intention of these principles is not to take a position at all, rather to be high level. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be inappropriate.
Jeff, also information that commissioners may want to submit, please have those go through Melissa, so that we can ensure that all three commissioners receive the same thing. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, and then the question of why to develop principles, it might be self-explanatory, but we do expect regional discussions to begin soon, at least for the district's involvement in those discussions to begin soon. And we acknowledge that a wide range of concepts are going to be discussed, many without clear answers. We don't know the range of what will be discussed. We don't know the range of what options will be put on the table, but we do know there is a wide diversity of viewpoints, and people are coming at this from many different angles. And so as we engage in these discussions, the principles, the idea behind them is that they will keep us anchored in our values, and they will keep us anchored in our commitment to our core commitment to safely and reliably serving electric power to our customers. And it allows us to allows us a framework to ensure that the range of considerations being discussed, will include those things that are important to our customers. That's sort of the lens that these principles were developed under.
Jeff, are you aware of the polling that's been done on this issue statewide and region-wide and so forth?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And you know that the majority of the citizens of this state hope that the dams will be breached. That's, you know, based on polling that I've read.
So
that's not really the intent of this discussion, Commissioner Wolf. The intent of this discussion is for the commission to coalesce around the guiding principles that we will use to enter into those discussions.
I understand. I was just a question for Jeff, because I think that we are involved in a political situation here, and we should be aware of what the general public and our public, I don't think we've done any polling on this, and we probably won't, of our own customers. But anyway, that's all I'm going to say about that.
And to your point, we are fully aware of the polling and all the work that's going on around the Lower Snake River dams from across the region.
Good.
We have folks that are heavily engaged in the process.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons we wanted to have a workshop instead of doing this in a presentation, is because like on the polling, there's been multiple polls reaching conflicting decision or conflicting conclusions on, you know, generation. There's multiple analysis reaching conclusions. And it's a lot to wade through because, you know, I mean, as you know, Commissioner Wolf, you know, some analysis is more reliable than others. And we also have our own internal analysis that we've done. And so it's just too much to wade through in a short presentation like this.
Oh, I agree. Yep.
So any other questions before I turn over to Garrison to get into the principles themselves?
No, Jeff, let's move on.
All right. So Garrison, I'll run the presentation, but it's to you.
Hey, perfect. Thank you, Jeff. Can you hear me? Am I coming up okay audio-wise?
Yes.
Awesome. Well, great. Well, let's walk through these then. And, you know, we've had some great discussion already. And just setting up the sequence here, you know, these principles are really about us talking as a group about what dimensions are important. And then we'll follow up with the workshop where we can present some of the diversity of analysis across these dimensions. We've got a two-step process set up for us and want to make sure that we talk through these pieces. So Jeff mentioned, why have the principles? You know, another piece that's important for us to think about is, you know, these regional discussions are a two-way conversation. And so, you know, I think that we want to take a look at some dimensions that are important for us to understand, and then also some dimensions that are important for us to share as a community. What are our goals? What are our obligations? So that, you know, we have that two-way exchange and that the dimensions of analysis can incorporate those things that might be important to our community. And one thing that you'll probably notice about these five principles is they're not remarkably different from how we would approach any other big issue for the most part, right? So reliable and safe power supply, you know, that's always one of our core obligations to our community. Ability to meet clean energy and carbon emission goals, maintain a low cost of public power, preserve local governance and environmental stewardship. These are the same dimensions that we think about when we look at long-term planning. And when we think about issues as diverse as, you know, the impact of organized markets or, you know, even how we'll model and account for climate change. So hopefully these are familiar and feel like decent starting points for us, but wanted to share that these are maybe universal pieces. And then we'll dive into some of the specifics here, just at that high principle level. And Jeff, I might ask you to move us forward right there. Perfect. So, you know, the first one, and again, kind of universal obligations is a PUD to our community, is making sure that we understand and have the ability to provide reliable power to our community. So this is something that we would want to make sure that there's detailed, credible analysis around. And you know, the reason for this is just what you would expect, that reliable power is bedrock of safety and economic stability for our community. We've definitely seen in the news in other places, thankfully far-flung places like Texas and California, that you know, blackouts there had a big impact, and that's not something that we want here. So just like we would approach any topic, we want to make sure that we're thinking about this and it's front of mind. The other piece that we know is that recent resource adequacy studies for our region have shown that we're in a transitional period. We have a challenge to meet, and without action, that challenge is going to be bigger. So we want to make sure that that is part of what we're thinking about as a region, and that we have a clear plan with detailed, credible information to make sure that our customers and our community is taken care of. So, you know, again, a universal that we would want to think about for any number of potential, you know, happenings or policy decisions. Another is that we're committed to providing clean power and leading on local and regional clean energy and carbon emissions goals. And this is a Snohomish specific thing, right? This is part of what makes us who we are. You guys all helped adopt the long-term resource plan, the IRP, the Clean Energy Action Plans, and those have us trying to get to 100% clean by 2030, the first possible part of that CETA compliance period. And that is a core part of what we're trying to do to lead the way. We know that there are other policies in development, whether that's the Climate Commitment Act and that carbon policy in our state, low carbon fuel standards, or just general efforts to electrify more sectors of the economy. And those are, you know, terrific environmental developments, and we are well positioned to lead the way there. What we want to make sure of is that any actions you know, don't impede our ability to lead the way there. And because we know that the federal Columbia River Power System acts sort of as a battery for the region, responding to changes in load and renewable energy, we know that that's a core part of what our existing plan is to meet those future challenges and remain a leader. So we want to make sure that we still have that ability and that we can plan for the future in the way that our community values. So again, just another one that's just a universal truism for us and one of the things that we think is important to think about. Another universal truism is that we know that affordability is really important to our customers. And as a public utility district, we have kind of a unique relationship with our customers and the product that we provide. You know, we're not profit motivated, we're service motivated. We receive our power from BPA at cost, and we provide the electricity that we have in our entire portfolio at cost to our customers. And as a result of that, you know, significant changes to BPA's cost, those will pass through to us and to our customers. And any significant changes in their portfolio, could create some impacts for us as well. And we just need to make sure that we understand what that looks like and that we have a clear plan for moving forward. And this is part of the unique position that we have as BPA's largest customer. It means that for significant BPA impacting decisions or policies, we have an outsized risk profile that's important for us to understand to take care of our community. Another one that we certainly talked about quite a bit when we were setting our long-term plan is just the important role of local governance and the ability of this commission to plan for the future using all the best information, thinking about what our constituents and community needs, and then executing on that plan. So, you know, we do view Snohomish PUD as an important stakeholder in the original discussions here because it could impact our future plans and we need to understand that. Things like the timing of any potential action, who pays, what delivery mechanisms might be considered, all of the pieces of that big equation, those are all important for us to understand so that as a community and as a commission, we can create plans that respond to that and set us up well for the future. So we want to make sure that we're in the loop. And Commissioner Wolf, I think you set it up well that we want to make sure that we have a shared sheet of music, we understand the diversity of thought on these issues, and that we can set ourselves up to be successful. And last, but certainly not least, in another universal truism that we bring to the table with all of our sort of long-term planning efforts is that environmental stewardship is a serious responsibility of us to our customers and to our community, and that we use best available science as a guide for prudent courses of action, and we want to make sure that we're doing a great job there. So obviously that's a huge consideration here. Salmon recovery does have an urgency to it, and we do want to be part of solutions for that in our region. So this is an acknowledgement that there are lots of different dimensions to this, and we want to make sure that we have the best balanced footing moving forward to address all these different things. So those are the five principles, and they are, not remarkably different than how we approach most topics, but those are the areas where we would want to dive deeper, share, Commissioner Wolf, to your point, the diversity of research that is out there. There's staff analysis that we would love to develop and share with you all, and that is kind of the framing for the conversation that we would like to have as we think about the regional discussion and how it impacts Snohomish PUD, our customers, and our future together. And we just want to make sure that we have a clear plan and a path forward. So that is the game plan, I would say. And I think if there's any questions, we're happy to field those. But I think the next step for us might be setting up this next commission workshop to coincide with the regional conversation.
This is Commissioner Wolf. I do want us to be a constructive partner in working with Senator Murray and Governor Inslee to secure a solution that works for salmon and the tribes and our communities and our public utilities. So I think these principles, as I see them, will provide for that. And I in some of the meetings that I attend, I think that there are some PUDs that are dismissive. They are not happy that Murray and Inslee came up with their plan or their, I don't know if you'd call it a plan. It's supposed to be a plan, but I want us to be a constructive partner in that process.
And that's our desire as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Let's see, John, do we have another item this morning?
Nope, that's it. If there's no further questions on this, I think we are, let me get back to my, yeah, I think we are good.
Well, let's see, Jenny, it looks like we have sufficient time. Should we have customers who want to comment, provide public comment on items, not on this afternoon's agenda, but in general, and each has a limit of 5 minutes. So Jenny, do we have anyone in the queue?
Yes, Commissioner Olson, we do. We have two. And actually, we'll have Gayla Schubik, if you'll unmute yourself, Gayla. Gayla, can you unmute yourself?
Yes, there just now was a place to unmute. It wasn't there before. Thank you very much. I am very pleased with what I've seen so far with what the PUD is doing at the state legislature. I've been spending a lot of time there myself watching committees and also what's on the floor. So keep up the good work there. And I'm very much looking forward to these workshops that you're talking about that Garrison was talking about for the Lower Snake. And so please be sure to get that information out. And if you will make it so that I can get it, I will certainly get it out to a lot of people, at least in my community and my various climate action groups that I'm a member of. So I'm looking forward to that. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And next we have Scott Levy, if you'd please unmute yourself.
Is Scott on? Good morning, Scott. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you. My name is Scott Levy. I have been involved in issues for Idaho salmon since 1994 when I began to film a documentary that was released in Sockeye up near where I live in Idaho. I'm not a commissioner, but I appreciate you hearing my comment. I'm not in your district. I mean, I live in Idaho near Redfish Lake, and we released 24 sockeye because the Endangered Species Act that was instituted for sockeye in 91. Anyway, that's how I got involved. And I'm an information advocate, so I have met with BPA, Don Harrison, Elliot Manger, Stephen Wright, Power Council, lots of people, go to lots of meetings. The one thing that seems to be missing from your information, from what you guys have heard, is that the Columbia River System Operations Environmental Impact Statement, the CRSO EIS, at the bottom of its Chapter 3 showed that prices will go down with the removal of Snake River embankments. Prices go down 5.1% to 15.1%. I think that's an important piece of information. I also noticed that you guys did not comment to the Northwest Power Council's 2021 power plan. They are set to vote to finalize that, but they may not be finalizing that yet. They may be running a remove Snake River embankment analysis. So that is all going to be talked about tomorrow at the council meeting, and I'll be making a public comment at the end of that. So I want to make myself available to you guys to answer any questions. Again, Scott Levy, I can be reached at redfish@bluefish.org. Happy to come and inform you all. I do my best to just present information and allow you guys just to be informed. That's really what I do when I talk to Elliot Manzer or Stephen Wright or John Harrison or whoever I'm talking to, is just so that people can be informed. So that's all I'm here to offer. But I want to point you all to the final table of Chapter 3 of the CRSO EIS showing 5% reduction in cost to Bonneville. Thank you.
And Scott, yes. Please follow, or perhaps someone in our service territory, or if you want to have a special notice of the workshop where we will be digging in And I would look forward to having you participate on that. It will be virtual.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be happy to take part and just be an information advocate like I've been doing for
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Do we have any other folks calling in? Jenny?
Yes, Commissioner Lookman, we have one more, or I'm sorry, Commissioner Olson, we have Tom Crisp. So Tom, if you'll please unmute yourself.
Thank you, commissioners. I'm Tom Crisp, a resident of Everett. I frequently attend Snowpud Commission meetings and have gained an insight and very appreciative of your responsibilities and judgment. As you develop plans to provide future electricity service, you've wisely incorporated conservation, efficiency, and new clean energy sources. It's true, the Lower Snake River dams have significant resource and they harm our fisheries and threaten survival of marine mammals such as orcas. The decision to remove the dams will cause changes to Snowpud's power resources. I'm confident that Snowpud will build reliable power portfolio without the Snake River dam's burdensome power. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. And again, if you have an opportunity when we set the date for our workshop to be able to dial in and listen to the workshop and make any comments that you might have.
Just for the record, that was Tom Crisp.
Well, who did I say, Commissioner?
Scott.
Well, what can I tell you?
Oh, well.
The old girl's mind is wandering. Thank you for that correction.
Oh, that's not a problem.
And Commissioners Olson, that's all we have for this morning.
All right, thanks. It is now 10:26, and we are recessing into an executive session for discussion of computer and telecommunications security and risk assessments if identifies vulnerability or if disclosure would increase risk under the terms set forth in the Open Public Meetings Act. It is anticipated the executive session will last approximately 30 minutes. Is that correct? John, is that correct, 30 minutes?
Yes.
All right.
Sorry, yes.
Well, we can extend if needed. And there will be no public comments. The regular meeting will reconvene virtually at 1:30 p.m. And a reminder, commissioners, I believe this is on the Teams platform. Is that correct, Melissa?
Yep.
That's correct.
I see Jenny shaking her head. All right.
Yes.
Would, commissioners, would you like to take a 5-10 minute break before we go into executive session?
5 minute break would work well for me.
Five, Commissioner Wolf, five. Good for you.
That's fine.
Mm-hmm. It's great for me. All right, we'll see you in 5 minutes.